So I'm heading towards the consistency conditions for how fields transform. And I was about to go down a rabbit hole here about the general representations of the Lorentz group, finite dimensional ones, which I think I'm going to defer because it's not really crucial for what I'm going to say next. And this is all very abstract, but in simple examples, you know what these matrices are, right? So right now we're talking about this is what it means to represent the Lorentz transformations on a quantity with collection of quantities where the collection is labeled by M. For a field, what'll happen is that in addition to the action of the symmetry on the labels, you'll have the action on the position of the field. And so there's a convention there that I don't want to lie to you about. So if I write out, let me write out this for a couple of simple examples that you're familiar with, like a scalar and a vector. So if I have a scalar field, A of x. So this is an example of representations. Lorentz reps on fields. If I take U of lambda, A of x, U inverse lambda, then what I'm going to get for a scalar field is just phi evaluated at the transform point. If I had done the same thing for a vector field, phi A, right, A. Should be the same thing, right? And what I would write here now, if I here this is what was playing the role of M over here. There'll be some matrix which is representing Lorentz transformations. And in this case, what will the matrix be? Lorentz transformations acting on a world index like that, that's how we define Lorentz transformations. We said that X mu went to lambda mu nu x nu for Lorentz transformations. That's all we had. And so the thing that's going to appear here, the d that's going to appear here, is lambda itself. This is the representation that is the defining representation for Lorentz transformations. And we have to do it for the inverse. So what we want to write here is this lambda inverse mu nu on A mu nu that's a particularly simple case of what we know what d is. If we'd had a tensor field here, we would have had pairs of these things. The way I want to write this, the defining property of these lambdas, was that was it alpha mu beta nu was equal to mu nu. And so what I want to do is another way of writing lambda inverse nu mu is to raise and lower the indices. I'm doing two steps at once. So Lorentz transformation comes to you with, sorry, I had it right, nu mu. The first index is upper and the second index is lower. And so the way we raise and lower indices is with eta. And so another way of writing this is that this is a statement that lambda inverse mu nu is basically lambda nu mu. Sorry, mu nu. Did I do that right?
Is it like the transpose of the?
Yeah, it should be the transpose, right? So I should have nu mu. This is lambda and if I'd asked you what the transformation of A would have been and you just walked in the room and didn't ask for anything fancy, this is what you would have written down. So what I want to just take these two examples and ask the question that I wanted to ask was we were going to take these fields, We're going to write them in terms of creation and annihilation operators. We know how those things transform. So in this particular example, what's the consistency condition for this particular transformation rule and the creation and annihilation operator rule? And what is it for this one? And you'll see that for this one, it's only consistent if the spin involved is zero. And this one, it'll only be consistent if the spin involved is zero or one. And in those two cases, the wave function is different. And basically, what you'll find is that this one is the gradient of this one if it's a spin zero. And so what's happening is that the consistency is determining these wave functions, and the different choices of fields for a given spin are just derivatives of one another. So it's, there's not a physics choice there, it's just a convenience choice. So to finish that story, and then I'll tell you what the answer is for general spins. And that's the part where you'd need to know the general transformation rules. So I'll just kind of give you a cartoon of what the general transformation rules are, but then just tell you the answer, because we're not going to need it in great detail. All we're going to really want to do in detail are these two anti-symmetric tensors, because that'll be the electromagnetic field, and spin a half fields, which we'll do in more detail anyway. So the next step, what I'd like to do is I want to write, this field in general, call it AM of X. Now we're going to write something like integral D3P, 2 pi to the 3 halves, some wave function that depends on P and sigma. If there's a sigma, we'll have to sum over it. We'll have an A of P sigma, e to the I, P dot X. And sigma is just whatever other labels we need to describe the Lorentz representation. And our goal is to try and figure out what these are. And so we know on this side of the equation what happens when we slap a UU inverse on it. And what we want to do is we want to figure out on this side of the equation what happens. And we get that from what the particles do. So we need to know what the particle representations. And so here, I'll just again sketch it, because I think this is the kind of thing that you're likely to have seen. So, we have these commutation relations that are conveniently are still here. We can choose things that are mutually commute. And one thing I didn't write here was that P mu and P nu do commute. That's another consequence of if I'd chosen, lambda equals 1 and just A, then nothing happens. And so we can diagonalize all the P's. That's the conventional choice, is that we will diagonalize all the P's. And so the way that you set up the representations, so your states will be labeled by P, so P mu, which will be the eigenvalue of P, the operator. I won't write the mu on the inside of the state. And what we want to know is how these extra labels get organized. And I want to just follow the ones that come from Lorentz transformations. You could have many labels for your particles. You could have many, many kinds of particles. So there could be all kinds of things that are in these labels sigma. But many of those labels won't change as you do Lorentz transformations. I just want to focus on the ones that are come with Lorentz transformations. And so the way you build these representations is you take a standard. These will be, because they're labeled by momentum, then in particular, P mu is going to be the energy of all these states is the square root of P squared plus M squared. And so these eigenstates all satisfy P mu is equal to minus M squared in the metric we're using. And so one of the Casimir labels of these representations is the mass. So we get to choose what the mass is. And so there's three cases that you normally talk about is the physical choices for P. There's the choice P mu equals zero, which is the trivial representation of the Lorentz group, and that's what the vacuum satisfies. So that's in that case, U is equal to one for all your transformations. There's representations where P squared is equal to zero, and P zero is the invariants are the Lorentz invariant quantities that you can build from P are the mass, and also the sine of P0 if p squared is less than or equal to 0. So if you have a time-like or a space-like vector, then the future-pointed versus past-pointed is a Lorentz invariant thing. And so the three categories of representation we would look at are the trivial one, which is the vacuum, basically. There's the ones for which p squared is 0, so it's a massless field, and it's future-pointed. And then there's the p squared is less than 0, future-pointed. And those are the three physical cases. And so in these two cases, the standard procedure is we choose a specific frame, a special frame, so we'll call that K. And the natural special frame to choose in the massive case would be the rest frame. That's the one where K is just equal to M0, 0, 0. And for a massless field, you can't do that. So the corresponding reference one, what we'll choose instead is something like, you know, omega 0, 0, omega. So it's something which is moving in the, you know, say in the z direction. And then what you do is you take all the Lorentz transformations and you ask which ones preserve this form. So that's the little group. So it's the lambdas for which lambda, so it's defined by my lambda mu nu k nu is equal to k mu. And so in this case, that's just the rotation. That's all rotations in space, basically. That's so lambda mu nu is equal to, you know, 1 in the time direction. And then rij, where this is an arbitrary orthogonal matrix. So the little group for a massive field is the rotations in three dimensions. And in the massless case, it turns out the little group is lambda is given by a boost, which I'll come back to. It's a two-parameter family of boosts, which I call it SAB. That's the notation I use in the notes. And then there's a rotation by an angle theta, which is the rotation around the direction of motion of the photon. So it would be a rotation in the xy plane. And the statement here is that the way you build the representations is you first take these the little group, and that acts on these states. If I have those act on the state where the momentum has been chosen to be the special value k, it just does whatever it does. So it's so for example, probably want to leave that here. So if I take the action of a Lorentz transformation, I take u of lambda in the little group. So let's say I say u of r acting on k sigma. This is a rotation, and it's going to act on the rotation labels that our particles have. And that's the thing that you know everything about in quantum mechanics, because that's how you quantify spin. So this is going to be given by some rotation representation, and it'll be labeled by a total spin j, and this label sigma will be the one that labels the third component of angular momentum. So let's call those, in my notes I called them d, but it was a curly d, and let's stick to that just so it doesn't. So we're going to have a d it's a matrix acting in sigma space, so write it as sigma prime sigma. And it depends on R. So it's defined for things in the little group. And K didn't change, and then sigma did change. And so these are the things that you know and love from quantum mechanics. And so in the notes, I put a little in brackets J here, because if you tell me the spin of the particle, then this will be a 2J plus 1 by 2J plus 1 dimensional matrix. Spin a half. In zero, this is just the unit matrix. It's just there's no label sigma, so this is just one. For spin a half, this is a 2 by 2 matrix, so it'll be the Pauli matrices, exponentials of the Pauli matrices, you know, and so on. For spin one, this will be the matrix R, because it's again the defining representation. And so in any particular spin, there's an explicit set of matrices here, and there's a I'm probably never going to use it, but what you normally specify is you know, so J3 acting on these states, sigma is just sigma. That's the label. And then instead of telling you what J1 and J2 are, J1 and J2 and J3 are the if I write these D's as these rotations as an exponential of something, these are the three generators of rotations. And what you normally define as J plus or minus, which is J1 plus or minus I J2, with some normalization here, which I'm not going to remember. And this raises sigma by 1 or minus 1 units, and there's a normalization, which I won't write. And so these are completely known matrices. If you tell me what the total spin is of the particle, and then once you've told me that, then sigma is equal to minus J, you know, minus J plus 1, J minus 1 to J, runs through 2J plus 1 variables, and it's the one that is changing when you do rotations. So if you know what the spin is of a massive particle, you know completely what the little group does. And so then all you have to do now is ask what happens to the if you do a transformation which is not in a little group. So the first thing to do is to take the Lorentz transformation that takes you from the special K to your favorite momentum. So if I ask, I'll define P sigma to be, you know, you give me a P, there will be a Lorentz transformation, I'll call it L of P, that, let me just call it L, that has the property that it takes K to P, as long as P squared is equal to minus M squared, where M is the same guy appearing here, there will exist a Lorentz transformation, and the notes writes it out explicitly if you weren't convinced. And so for that particular L, what we do is we define P sigma to be a representation of that L on K sigma up to a normalization. It's the first one. It's again this issue of the you want to make these D's satisfy that D of R1, D of R2 is equal to D of R1, R2. And that's the way I'm setting this up, that'll happen if I sum over the first index.
Oh, okay.
So it's very much like the inverse story over there. So there's several things to go on. So this is how I'll define, you know, I'll get to a non-zero momentum by acting on the basic state with the special momentum with the Lorentz transformation that in space would have taken me between those two momenta. And then from that, I can now figure out what the action of U is on the state just by chasing through the algebra, because I know that if I act with a U of lambda, I'm going to get U of lambda times U of L, and we can then I can write U inverse U to write this as a matrix acting on the same state P sigma again. And so from that, and using this property, you can kind of bootstrap your way up to see how a general transformation acts on a general state, given that the general state is defined this way. And I'll do that in a second, but first I want to talk about this normalization. That normalization you may not be used to seeing there, because it's a function of how you normalize your momenta. And so so let me do an aside on that, because that's something which is otherwise an annoying. So I'm using, if you normalize your momenta in a Lorentz covariant way, what will happen is that these ends are just one, essentially. But I'm using the, you know, when I started off, I told you that we're using a Dirac. We're using the normalization you would have used for continuum states if you were just doing non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you know, in as an undergraduate. And because of that, these are not covariantly normalized. And so it's because of that that if you ask, it, you know, it, if I call if I define this, this is a state whose inner product would have a 1 over E here, And that's what you need to make this delta function become Lorentz covariant. And so what's going to happen is that those n's I'm going to have over there will be ratios of these square roots, because that's what you need to have the state, both of these states, transform in the right way. So let me just write that. Again, this is in the notes in more detail. This will be E of p divided by E of this, which is just m. So if I divide this by the square root, I've got something which is normalized the same way as this one was, which is what that said over there. The modulo of that point, we can now, so the missing step here was I wanted to, we can write down explicitly what the transformation rule is. Let's do that here. All right, so what we want to do is we want to take U of lambda acting on P sigma. And we know P sigma is just defined over there, so it's the square root of E of P over M, U of lambda, U of L, K sigma. And so what I'll do now is what do I want to insert here? I want to insert. I need to be more specific about what L is. I should put, let me write L of P here, because it's for every P, there's a different L. I'm looking for an answer which will be let me insert here U inverse of L of lambda p, U of L of lambda p. That's just one. And this guy acting on this guy will just be the state lambda p. So I'll write this and I'll have square root of E of p, m U of lambda, U of L of P, U inverse of L of lambda P times lambda P sigma. Now this combination here, because of these are all just Lorentz transformations, this is U of lambda L of P, L inverse of lambda P. Somehow I think I got the order wrong. If I've done this right, this should be something which if I act on a, this should be in the little group. Let's just check that. No, I think my first line was just off by a little bit. I almost pulled it off here. Just a sec. Let me just make sure I get it right. Ah, that's what I did wrong. I led you astray here. I was right to be specific about what I wanted to write here was U of L of lambda p. Because what that's saying is that this is lambda p sigma. And I'm trying to derive, I'm expecting that U acting on p to give me the Lorentz transform of p, that state. And that state is by definition the basic state acted on with this specific transformation. So the step I should have written first was this is a normalization times this. And the normalization now is going to be the square root of E lambda p. That should be here. Because it has to, the thing that will be invariant is the state divided by the square root of the energy. So now what I'll do is I'm going to do what I said I was going to do here. I'm going to insert this, but I'm going to do it for L of p. And I stick that in there. So now what I'll have is I'll have I'm in such danger of lying to you that I want to make sure. So I got lambda. No, actually, I had it right the first time. Oh, failure of confidence. Yeah, oh, sorry, I was good. I should have just trusted my instincts. So let's go back to where we were. So this, I was, so the logic of it was we had that normalization, we had U of L of, no, let me make sure I don't, no. Now I've lost my confidence here, I'm gonna read it to you here. So what I should have done is I should have just written out what P is, right? So it's, I've got U of lambda, I've got U of L of P, okay. Sigma. Nobody could argue with that because I just told you what this is. And then, so the square root, U of lambda. All right, so now I can just multiply that out. That's U of lambda L of P. Then I'm going to insert now U inverse L of lambda P. U of L of lambda p, k sigma. So this I can write as, this is just lambda p sigma up to that normalization story. Or actually, no, without the normalization story, because that comes in with a matrix. No, with the normalization story, right? So I have a square root of k, that'd be m over e of lambda p. And this is U of lambda L of P, L inverse of lambda P. Good. Now the claim is that this is something that lives in the little group. That's a Wigner rotation. What's the simplest way to show you that? Oh, and I guess the other thing is the order of those guys. L of lambda p. Because of this index story here, you know, I summed over this guy. It's the matrix that's appearing is going to be the inverse of this matrix. So the guy I want to the guy I'm interested in is the inverse of this guy. So it's L of lambda p lambda L of p. That acting on k, that gives me p, that gives me lambda p, and then that gives me, that's an L inverse, that gives me back k again. So this combination acting on K takes it back to K. So that means it's in the little group. And if I've done this right, I should have got that as the argument of U. And I think, right, so U inverse of, this is U of L inverse. And that's what I wrote. And there's an ordering of operations that I've got wrong here. Do you guys see what I've done wrong?
What is the purpose of this calculation?
Andre's trying to do is convince you that when I act on an arbitrary state with a Lorentz transformation, I'm going to get, I can write that in terms of these matrices, which have only been defined for things that preserve the basic standard state. And so what I need to do is write, the thing that's throwing me off is that the action of this, of U should be, what I'm doing is I'm doing it backwards because I'm giving you what, I think what I've done wrong is here. This is. Oh, all right. I know what I did wrong. I did a stupid thing. And the stupid thing was I just inserted the one, instead of inserting it here, I wanted to insert it over here. So it's, where's the line I did that? So we're good here. What I want to do is this part is still okay too, because I want to write it in terms of lambda p. But U of lambda, L of lambda p, U of L lambda p inverse. Yeah, that's what it is. This is what I wanted to write. So if I've done that right, right, and that's all that's saying is, yeah, I should have, this is the line I didn't want to write. So this line is just true because what I've done, all I've done is stupid, right? So this times this is 1. U of lambda is U of lambda. U of L of P acting on K is P, right? So this is a manifestly true line. And I got into trouble with that line. So now having written this line, now we should be in good shape.
So the first line is not true. The second line is
true. Yeah, I'm not sure why the first line shouldn't be true. This first line, these are the same line, actually. They just differ by inserting the UU inverse here. Right. So now this is something which is something which is living inside the little group, because L of lambda P inverse lambda L of P acting on K is L of lambda P inverse acting on lambda acting on P, by definition of what L is. And so that's L of lambda P inverse times so this is defined to be the thing that takes lambda p to k. Here's lambda p that it's acting on, so this is just k. So whatever this is, it's a rotation. And it's normally called the Wigner rotation that goes with lambda and p. So that means the action of this thing on this state, we know what it is, because that's what these d's were. And so this is the square root of U P over M. So this U is going to go past this matrix now. So I got a sum over sigma prime of curly D of sigma prime sigma, which depends on what spin J we're talking about. It's a function of this W. That's the rotation that we're representing. That's the only thing we know how to represent. This operator just goes right through now and acts on that guy. And so it gives me lambda P sigma. This is in the little group. Sorry about that. That was not the best board work. So that's basically now the statement is that's telling you the action of what U is on the states. And so if I think of the state P sigma as being A star P sigma acting on the ground state, and if I think of the U acting on the ground state is always giving me back the ground state because it's Lorentz invariant, then from this and this and this, I can figure out what the analog of this statement is for the creation and annihilation operator. Let me just quote you the answer, because I can see that I'm not going to be able to do algebra with jet lag. Let's just.
I think the first equation is correct. It's just you're inserting unity at.
Right, right. That's right. All right. All right, so the bottom line of that whole sad story is that I left my page here, so just bear with me for a second.
Sorry, can I just see the last the last board?
Yeah, while I'm finding this thing, let me. I can see that I should print out these notes, because the flipping around and finding the page is not working very well. Here we go. Are you good? Can I lower it? Yeah. So the bottom line of that whole story was U of lambda of A of P sigma, U inverse of lambda, is going to be given by all those things that are appearing over there. So there's a square root of the energy of lambda p. Of course, I used k instead of p of p. Sum over sigma prime d of j sigma prime sigma for the Wigner matrix lambda and p. A of lambda p sigma prime. So you see what's happening is that it's kind of what you expect to happen is that you do a Lorentz transformation on this and you get the Lorentz transform momentum, but you also shuffle the spins because in general, when you do a boost, this rule over here, the one in the board I just hid is showing you that there's generally, in general, for an arbitrary boost, there's a Wigner rotation you have to do. And every rotation you do shuffles up these spin indices. So now the punchline is, if you know that this is true for a field, there's a version of it. Yeah, this is true for the fields. And if you know that creation annihilation operators are satisfying this, then if you believe that this is also true, and let's do it for, let's start off doing it with a scalar field. So then U doesn't depend on, has no index. Then the claim is that now it's a group theory exercise to learn what these U's are. And what you do is you just slap U inverse around this and evaluate this side using that and this side using this. And that gives you a consistency condition that the U's have to satisfy.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But why Wigner rotation depends on lambda?
Because it depends on so this is what W is. And so it's explicitly depending on lambda and P. OK, and so the consistency condition says that the sum over sigma of the curly D for the spin J of sigma prime sigma of the Wigner rotation that depended on lambda and P times this U, which depends on P and sigma. It has to be equal to, in this case of a scalar field, it has to be equal to the square root of E of lambda P over E of P times the matrix that would appear here or would appear here, but which for the scalar field isn't there, times U of lambda p sigma prime. So the logic is this is consistent with that and that if and only if U satisfies this. So you're looking for solutions to this. And the way you find solutions for this is you just choose special values for lambda and p. So you first choose, if you choose a p which is not in the special frame, then this is just basically telling you how to construct u for a general p from the u that would be defined in the special frame k. And then if you specialize to the case where lambda and p are giving you, I can choose a lambda and p such that both sides of this equation involve u of k and sigma. And in that case, this becomes a consistency condition for that specific frame. And so the first piece of information is just telling you how to extend the definition of u from the rest frame to the general frame. The self-consistency issue is happening when you choose lambda and p such that this is both sides are in the rest frame. So I guess we choose lambda p to be k. So we choose p to be k, and we choose lambda in the Litter group. And then this would be k, and then this is now a consistency condition for u. And so in the case that lambda is in the Litter group and p is equal to k, this just says that sum over sigma of d of j of sigma prime sigma and a w of a Litter group and p is just going to be the Litter group guy. That'll be, so let's call lambda equals r because it's in the letter group. So we'll just get d of r. That has to be equal to, or sorry, times u of k sigma is equal to square root of e of lambda p, or lambda, so that's now k, and this space is just k, so this is m, and this is also, in this case, if the square root goes away, because if p is in the rest frame and this is in the little group, then this is k, that's k, so these are both m, and this is going to be equal to u of k sigma prime. And this is an explicit rotation matrix. So you give me a J, you know, if this is a spin a half, these are exponentials of Pauli matrices. If this is spin one, this matrix is the matrix R, and so on, right? So it's so you can kind of see that the if this is the matrix R, for example, there's no for generic R, there's no unit matrix. There's no unit eigenvector for a generic rotation matrix. And so the only solution to this is going to be zero. If J is not zero. So the claim is that if the only solution is U equals zero, if J is not equal to zero. If J is equal to zero, then there's no sigmas anymore, and then this D is just, you know, one. And so then this condition evaporates. And so that's the way you see that a scalar field can only represent spin zero particles. So that's kind of the least interesting example. But if you do the same thing now, for spin one, it's the same logic. And so all that changes is that this is not changing. So now what will happen is that over here, I'll get the Lorentz transformation acting on. So now if we had had a spin one, we would have had u mu, and we would have had a four vector u mu. So when we arrive down here, we'll have a u mu. And then let me again check that I'm not lying to you before I do it. So I'll get a d, I'll get a lambda, right, lambda u nu of lambda p sigma prime. So all that's happening is that, you know, before that this matrix D was trivial, but now it's not trivial. So now in this case, this is the thing that's coming from the transformation of the field. This is the thing that's coming from the transformation of the particle. And so you can kind of see that the in the rest frame, what's going to happen is that we're going to get this acting on u mu will be now lambda mu nu u nu of k sigma prime. And then there's two solutions. If we take the j equals zero, so if we make this trivial, and so there are no sigma labels, then what we're going to have here is u mu is equal to a rotation, this lambda is r. It'll be the r here acting on u. So we're asking u to be the one, we want u to be a vector for which r does nothing, because r acting on u is going to give us u back. And we know what that is. That means that u is proportional to k. So that implies, in this case, if j equals 0, in this case now, if j equals 0, then the consistency condition is that that u mu of k had to be equal to, you know, r or lambda mu nu u nu of k. For the specific choice of lambda in the little group. And so that means that since the little group just rotates space and doesn't touch time, that means that u mu has to be proportional to k mu. And if I now go back to this expression, if I know that u is, if u in the rest frame is k mu, when I go to the general frame, u mu will be proportional to p mu. And so this is going to be sum over sigma integral d3p over 2 pi to the 3 halves. There's something I forgot to say in the scalar case. This thing here, in the scalar case, the answer was not that u was a constant. The answer was that u was the ratio of the square roots. And so the ratio of the square roots says that for a scalar field, we would have had 1 over the square root of twice the energy. And that 2 is conventional. And that's just designed to make the canonical commutation relations for this agree with the ones, the creation annihilation ones for this. But that square root of e is coming because of this part of the consistency relationship. And for a vector field, we have the additional information that this is proportional to p mu times a number times a p sigma e to the I p dot x. And that's just, of course, a number times the derivative of what we would have said for a scalar field. And so that's just showing you that if you just ask for the group theoretical consistency between spin zero and a vector field, they can be consistent, but only if the vector field is a gradient. And then it's not a big surprise because the thing it's a gradient of is a scalar field, which we knew could represent a spin zero particle. And if you do the same thing for spin one, all you learn is that this u has to be orthogonal to k, because you'll have the three choices of spin. You can just choose the polarization, three polarizations to point in the three directions of space, and that will satisfy this consistency condition. And that just shows you then that if the vector is representing spin one, it has to be divergence free, which is to say you're projecting out the spin zero part. Whew. That was a cumbersome but cool. And so the bottom line that comes out of this is, because of the way I'm normalizing momentum, you always have this square root of 2 times the energy. The square root of energy is coming into the denominator here all the time, and that's consistently going to be in the expansion of all the fields for that reason, for any spin. The 2 is a convention, but it's a useful one because it relates the creation annihilation commutation relations for A to the canonical one for if you have the momentum and the field commute in the standard way. So that's how you choose this constant normally, that constant was chosen to make that 2 there. So I don't need that anymore. Because this argument is only up to normalization. Anything that solves this equation, I can multiply it by a number and I'll still solve the equation. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, in general, you can do this exercise for arbitrary representation of the field and arbitrary spin. And let me just tell you the answer there, rather than trying to go through the answer, rather than trying to derive it. And so there, let me just make the statement so you know what the notation is. And I just erased the one equation I wanted to keep in the board, but oh well. So the that commutation relation for the J's, J mu nu, J lambda rho, was equal to stuff. That has a simple way of, you can write it in a way which looks like SU2. Let me give it to you. Here we go. So if I define ji, so this is three guys, so it's a vectors for the j's. If I define that to be 1/2 epsilon I jk, this is a completely anti-symmetric guy, times j jk, and I define ki to be ji zero. This is the thing that generates the rotations. This is the thing that I was using would be the thing that generates these rotations in space. And these are the ones that generate the Lorentz boosts. So there's three of them because you can boost in the x, y, and z direction. It mixes space and time. If you ask what this commutation relation is, I won't write it again. In terms of these guys, it becomes these guys satisfy the rotation algebra, I epsilon I K L J L. And then the K's, the J with K is just going to say, it's going to express the fact that K is transforms like a vector. So we'll have J I K L is equal to I epsilon I L M K M. And then the K with itself, K I with K J, that's equal to minus I epsilon ijk times jk. So this is just rewriting this thing in a This was a Lorentz invariant way of writing it, Lorentz covariant way of writing it. This is now the rotational way of writing it. And the observation is, if I take, I define A to be 1 half J plus I K, and B to be 1 half J minus I K, then A and B commute with each other. And A satisfies the same algebra as the J's did. And so does B. So A goes to B. And so you see that this is a way of showing you that the what's happening is that, you know, the important thing here is that we took a complex linear combination of these generators. It's not true that the Lorentz group is the same as SU2 cross SU2. But if I complexify the k's, then the algebra that we get for I, k, and j is the group SO4. And SO4 is the same as SU2 cross SU2, which is why this is working, essentially. So it's a four-dimensional specific statement. And so that means that if you know how to represent these matrices A and B, you also know how to represent the j's and the k's. And that means you also know how to represent the j mu nu's. And so, you do know how to represent these because they're just satisfying the rotation algebra. That's the thing that was being described by J equal to, you know, 0, a half, 1, and so on. And these sigmas are running from minus J to plus J. So that means that I can label an arbitrary finite dimensional representation of the Lorentz group in terms of two spin-like things. And that's what the labels mean. And so in AM, what I would do is I'd write it as AB, where A is the sigma for this guy, and B is the sigma for this guy. And it's characterized, let me not call this A, let's call it phi. And I'll characterize the representation is labeled by the total spin for these two guys, capital A and capital B, which is the analog of J for the spin. We've been talking about spin. And so the dimension of these representations is going to be 2A plus 1, because that's how big this representation is, times 2b plus 1. That's the dim dimension of the representation. So you can go through the lowest dimension ones and identify the ones that you know, like the four vectors and things, by counting up the states in any one of these ways of writing it. So let me switch the order here. And I'm just telling you this not because I need you to know how these things transform, but just because I want to give you the final statement of what the answer is if you did this exercise in the general case would be. So if yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, just a quick question. So you said that like SU2 is the same as SO4, but wouldn't it be like, you know, because SO4 is like Euclidean rotation, but here it would be like 4D rotation, but with the Minkowski metric,
SO4, so the IK takes so J and K are the Hermitian generators of Lorentz group.
Okay.
But if I defined, you know, X to be IK, so it's no longer Hermitian.
Oh.
If I took that to be Hermitian and I said what satisfies the, if I had Hermitian guys that satisfy the algebra I get by making that replacement, that would be O4. So that would be the Lorentz group in Euclidean space because of that extra I.
So it's a bit like when you define imaginary time, it's like if you have like
a, kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And then it's just true that at the algebra level, O4 is like SO3, like O3 cross O3.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So. So you can always label things, you know, A, B. So if you go through the simplest ones, you know, 0, 0 is a one-dimensional representation. That's a scalar. You know, 1 half 0 is a two-dimensional representation. And that's a left-handed spinner. And 0, a half is a right-handed spinner. So they're distinct. You know, the same thing, if I take the complex conjugates, you can kind of see that the A and B get switched because of that I. And so the complex conjugate of a left-handed spinner will be a right-handed spinner. And the fact that they're different shows you that they're not real representations. 1 half, 1 half, that's a 2 times 2 is 4-dimensional representation. That's the 4 vector. This would be psi left, this would be psi right, this would be, you know, v mu. 1, 0 is, one way to think about that is that if, one way to think about this one, if you want to see exactly how you make the map between these guys, this one is the product of that times that. So it's a left-handed spinner times a right-handed spinner, and that's giving you a four vector, but that's something you knew, because if I had a psi left bar gamma mu psi right, that's something which is a vector. So this is just expressing that, and this is really counting at some level the spinner labels in that way. So the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient that gives you that takes you from this to this is the gamma matrix. And in a similar way, this 1, 0 is like it's like this with itself. And if I take two spin a half objects and I take the product of them, I get either a spin 0 or a spin 1. If I take a spin 0, I'd get this. So that says that there's a scalar combination of two left-handed spinners, which you would have believed anyway. But there's also a vector. There's also another combination which is not a scalar, and that's the thing that is the anti-symmetric combination of two gamma matrices. That's also non-zero between two left-handed spinners because there's an even number of gamma matrices. So this is something which is an anti-symmetric tensor, and so is this for the same reason, and they differ because of the left versus right. And it's an easy exercise. You can kind of go through, and if you contract this with epsilon mu nu lambda rho, and this with epsilon mu nu lambda rho, this one gives you plus I times gamma again, gamma lambda rho, and this one gives you minus I because of the left versus right. And so this is a self-dual. So I f is equal to 1/2 epsilon mu nu lambda rho f lambda rho. And this is an anti-self-dual, so minus I f mu nu is equal to 1/2 epsilon mu nu lambda rho, f lambda rho. And these are the only ones we're going to need. If you did a 0-2, that would be something that has the properties of the Riemann tensor, essentially. And a 2-0 would be the Riemann tensor. And so now, given that, the answer that you get by this exercise for the consistency of spins to field transformations, there's a general answer. And it depends on if you're massive or not. So for massive fields, so then those are labeled by total spin. All that really counts is total spin. Then the statement is that there exists a field psi in the AB representation can represent spin J, massive particle. If and only if J is equal to the absolute value of A minus B, A minus B plus 1 up to A plus B. So if you thought of these as two spins and you multiply them together, it's all the spins that could have given you in the general rules of combining spins. You get anything from A minus B to A plus B in steps of. And that fits the examples we've looked at so far. So if we had a half a half, then we would have gone anywhere from 0 to 1. If 0, 0 has to be 0, and so on. And if you do the same thing for massless fields, I didn't say this explicitly, but the same thing will go through. There'll be a story where if I act on the state with a Lorentz transformation, there'll be some representation of the little group. And in that case, the little group was not rotations in space. In that case, for massless fields, the little group was a two-parameter family of boosts times a rotation around the axis around the direction the photon is moving. So if the photon, if k mu for a massless field is omega 0, 0, omega, r here would be, 1 cos theta sine theta minus sine theta cos theta 1, and everything else 0. Now, what happens is that if these guys are represented by something non-trivial, if this is not represented by the unit matrix, then what will happen is that your label sigma will include a continuum of parameters, which will be generated by these A's and B's, so that there will not be a finite number of spin states in your whatever you're describing. It doesn't mean it can't exist, but if you restrict yourself to particle states which have a finite number of spin states, then S has to be 1, essentially. That's the way you have to represent it on the standard state. And then all you're doing is then representing this rotation, and it's just a U1 thing, so it's a phase. So what happens is that the matrix D for this rotation acting on the standard K, it's going to have another label. I'll say what it is in a second. It's just going to be e to the I lambda theta, where that's that theta K. So the other label is just this eigenvalue lambda. And so lambda is some, this is the helicity of the massless particle. And there's nothing that forces you to have more than one helicity. So if I don't think I'll do it, but if you go through the action of parity, you can repeat the exercise for parity, because what I'm describing here can be done for any Lorentz transformation, and in particular for the improper ones. And what you find for parity is that parity changes the sign of lambda. And so if you have a parity invariant system, if you have one lambda, you have to have the other lambda too, if lambda is not zero. If you have lambda, you have to have minus lambda. So in parity invariant systems, you'll get massless particles coming in pairs of helicities, but that's not forced on you by the proper group. So given that the lambda is what you're talking about is the eigenvalue, it turns out that the analog of the story for massless fields is psi element of AB can represent massless particle with helicity lambda if and only if lambda is equal to B minus A. So that's the general statement, is that which fields represent which ones, which particles. And so in particular, you see that, so for massive fields, let's see, massless, this guy is always spin zero. This guy is always spin a half. In this case, this has to be, so B minus A would be, this has to be a helicity minus a half. Here you can have spin a half, but here you have to have helicity plus a half. Here, in the massive case, we saw that that could be 0 or 1. But in the massless case, this has to be 0, because B minus A is 0. In this case, it's 0. It's basically 1, spin 1. This has to be spin 1. In the massless case, this is helicity minus 1, and this is helicity plus 1. And so that kind of makes sense, because these are the two helicity states of the electromagnetic waves. So that kind of fits this story for the massless case. But the surprise is this one. You might have thought that this guy is the guy who should have been representing a massless particle. And the reason that the electrostatic potential there's not a contradiction between the statement that this cannot represent a massless particle is if we go through the exercise of figuring out if we do this exercise here that told us what, in this case for a massive spin one, a spin zero particle, we found that the polarization had to be this, and it had to be proportional to p mu. If we'd done that exercise in this case, and if I wrote out what f mu nu is as a function of, explicitly what the polarization tensors were, what we would have found is that f mu nu would be the integral of sum over lambda, if there was a more than one lambda, d3p, 2 pi to the 3 halves, square root of twice the energy, it's always there. Now, this is just momentum, the magnitude of the momentum, because this is the massless guy. And then we would have had a p lambda e to the I px. And then we would have had some u mu nu of p and lambda. And what that would have turned out to be would have been up to normalization. It would have been p mu times a particular combination u nu, which is not, it's similar to what you would have gotten for a massive field, minus u mu p nu for some u. That's what's forced on you by requiring this transformation rule under Lorentz transformations to agree with the massless spin one transformation rule there. And that says that this is the curl of something, which sounds right. But if I ask, how does this thing, so this something is, it's not just anything, that a mu is going to be the sum over lambda of integral d3p over 2 pi cubed square root of twice the energy, times a p lambda e to the I px u mu of p lambda. So whatever this thing was here, that's going to be the guy that's going to appear there. And so now if I take u of lambda a mu of x u inverse of lambda, and I ask what's this equal to, I can evaluate it because I can do this. I can apply those things to this guy, and I just go through the exercise of seeing what happens. And what you find is that you get lambda nu mu or mu nu a nu of lambda x plus the derivative of something. It doesn't matter what the something is, but it's something you can construct out of these guys. And so you can kind of see that the reason that this is not inconsistent with the general statement over there for massless particles, I can't represent the thing that the four vector, the quote four vector that I would try and build using a massless spin one particle actually does not transform like a four vector because this didn't stop here. This is something which is not a four vector, but it's a four vector up to a gauge transformation. So if you're in the business of making Lagrangians for this, which we will be because this is about QED, as long as you never use A, you don't need to worry about gauge invariance. You'll build things out of F. There will be a gauge invariance for free because F is always, it's always true that you can write F as the curl of something and the gradient will drop out of this, but you don't care because you're just basically using F anyway. But if you ever want to have a static interaction which is not derivatively suppressed, like the Coulomb interaction, for example, then you're going to need to build it using A. And then if you want it to be Lorentz invariant, you're going to have to build it so that it's also invariant under shifts of A goes to A plus gradient. So if you tried to have a piece in your Lagrangian or your Hamiltonian, which was J mu A mu, that's only going to work if this whole thing, it's really going to be your action, which is the integral d4x of that. Then it's going to be important that if I replace this by a gradient, that I get nothing. And so if I integrate by parts, it'll work if I could couple it to conserved currents. And so you can kind of see that the massless spin bigger than a half particles are going to be special because these things that are undifferentiated, the general rules for what the fields are from the consistency of Lorentz transformations is forcing you to have derivatives in your or momenta in your polarization vectors. And so if you want to have interactions like gravity or electromagnetism, which do not involve derivatives, then you're forced to be building in this gauge invariance, a gauge invariance of some sort. And that's something which you see in other ways of approaching things, because if you do the way you probably learned about these fields in introductory class, if you count the fields and you count the particle states, you knew that there are too many fields if you have a large number of indices here. Because the massless particles in a parity invariant theory, there's always just two of them. And so having a bigger and bigger representation is more and more redundant. And this is the way you see that from this representational way of thinking about fields and the consistency of expanding them. I forgot to put my Klein thing on, but I see it's 4. The last thing I'm going to say here, I'll say at the beginning of next time, and that will be once you see this, then the only thing you're missing for the CPT theorem, the spin statistics theorem, and the antiparticle existence story is if you try to make Lorentz invariant Hamiltonians, you're trying to make a local Hamiltonian or a Hamiltonian, which is an integral d3x of some local Hamiltonian. A sufficient condition you might have thought for making everything Lorentz invariant is to make this thing Lorentz invariant, make it a Lorentz scalar. And so build it out of these guys in such a way that it's a Lorentz scalar. And that fails. And it fails, even that simple ansatz fails. And it fails because what's the goal? We're trying to make the Lorentz transformations commute with the S matrix. But the S matrix, you remember, you can write it as a sum n equals 0 to infinity of minus I to the n over n factorial time ordered product of, of interaction Hamiltonian, at x1. There's an integral going on here that I haven't written. So integral t1 dtn of a time-ordered product of h of t1 H of Tn. You're all happy with this expression for the S matrix, are you? So that's the kind of thing, if not, it's easy to fill it in, but it's just a standard perturbation story for what the S matrix is. If this is Lorentz invariant, a Lorentz scalar, that's not sufficient for this to commute with the Lorentz transformations, and the problem is the time ordering. And the reason that's a problem is that if you think about two times, you know, T1, T2, as long as they're time-like separated or null-separated, everybody agrees what the order is. But if they're space-like separated, there's different observers think, you know, some observers think that's earlier than that, and other ones think that's earlier than that. So that means that the time ordering will only be, can only hope to be Lorentz invariant if it's true that for space-like separations, these Hamiltonians commute with each other. And so that means that the Lorentz invariance will force you to require the interaction Hamiltonian to commute at space-like separations. And that means that, and if you build things out of these A's, that will be false, because these A's and the A stars, if you complex conjugate this thing to get A stars, they never commute at space-like separations. And so you're forced to add something which will make things commute, and that's where the antiparticles will come from. And then the requirement that they commute is all the details of the spin statistics come from that requirement that everything cancels in the commutator of H with itself at space-like separations. I'll just sketch that. That shouldn't take very long to sketch that, hopefully. I get it right. What I would do then is the plan is to write down what's the analog of this for a spin a half particle. We have it for a spin one particle now. And so that tells us what the fields are for QED. And so then we can start writing down what QED will look like. And I want to show you the next step will be, even if you did the make these guys commute, you're still screwed. Because what will happen is that the time-ordered products of pairs of vectors is not going to be a tensor. It's going to be a tensor up to a thing that's still not covariant. And so you have to cancel that too. And so it's one of these things that, you know, you can see why people were so depressed in the 30s and 40s before a manifestly covariant way of doing things came about, because it looks like it should be so easy, but every time around every corner there's a landmine. And so the non-covariant interactions that we're going to need in the what happens in real life is that the failure of covariance in the time ordering cancels a failure of covariance in the Hamiltonian. It will not be a scalar; it'll be a non-covariant thing, and the non-covariance will go through and here will cancel the non-covariance here in a way which looks like a miracle. And there's no way that you'd expect it to work, but if you do things canonically. You might have thought that you're going to have to, how do you dream up the non-covariance here to make it all work? And in the electromagnetic case, it's the Coulomb interaction which is doing the job for you here. And the canonical, the point of the canonical quantization program is that it's an algorithm where you turn the crank and it gives you all the right interactions here in just the way you need to go through and cancel all these non-covariant things if your action had been invariant that you started with. And so that's where we're going in day two. All right, thank you.